Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schanklerberg, and I've got John Paskowicz on the line. Hey, John.
Good morning, Fred. Good morning. To talk with you.
Yeah, and so hopefully everything's going well. We're recording kind of first thing, at least for me, Monday morning. I think you're further east, so you're probably well into the week. So hopefully everything's shaping up well and you're having fun.
Yes, getting things done before the holidays here, and also preparing for RAMS in January, doing a tutorial there, and maybe we can follow up with some podcasts with myself and others while we're at RAMS.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and we should mention this recording should come out, I think, early January, somewhere in there, so it should be a couple of weeks before RAMS. And as a listener, if you're going to RAMS, if you're planning to be in Orlando, I think it's the last week, the 20-somethings January, get a hold of us. We'd love to sit down and chat with you. I'm going to be bringing my recording equipment and a couple of lapel mics. And like we did last year, we'll actually do recording like the premise of this show was based on sitting at RAMS with some people saying, well, how do we keep this conversation going that we enjoy at RAMS? How do we take it forward? So that's how the podcast got started. And we'd like to actually do that. And so if you're a listener and would like to get on the show with us, just let us know. And we'd love to sit down and chat with you and put a microphone in front of you. It's not too intimidating. It's kind of fun.
Okay.
All right. So, John, one of the things that thinking about RAMS, and I know that a good part of the audience at RAMS are first-time attendees to that conference, and oftentimes they're sent by a manager or a boss, or they're looking at how to get started as a reliability engineer. And one of the things I remember from way back when I was getting started was this design engineer swiveling around in his chair and giving me this evil look saying, you know, every time you show up, you tell me something's not working. You know, please don't tell me that, you know, help me find a solution to this stuff. Don't bring me problems, bring me solutions. Have you ever run into that?
Yeah, that's right. Most of them initially have kind of an adversarial relationship with reliability. Hey, you're slowing up my getting this product done, and that's not the case. We're really trying to help them. Mm-hmm. The thing I found, though, is a lot of, at RAMS and other conferences, there's a lot of, some of them are students that are doing academic things. There's colleges, you know, having a group of people presenting their work. They're usually mm-hmm. grad students, or they're relatively early in their career and have not had a lot of exposure to reliability. And I found that typically engineers coming out of school don't get that much exposure to reliability unless they take an elective course in reliability. Mm-hmm. Most curricula don't really include a whole lot on it. So I've found that in industry, as we bring on new engineers, kind of got to educate them on reliability methods and what we're trying to do.
Yeah, unfortunately, they might learn about it when they're, you know, an angry customer's calling saying, you know, this is a great feature you designed into it, but it only worked once. You know, so come on, let's make it work for longer. It's what I'm paying for. It's not just one time.
We was talking about accelerated testing. That's where, you know, we get into that discussion where, hey, you're destroying my product, you're overstressing it. The part of it is when you're working with designers in an accelerated test is, yeah, we're going to find issues, but then you got to come up with, okay, here's things that could cause that, and here's some ways we might be able to improve that design and have them involved in the process, and that seems to help a lot.
What often connects with, you know, most designers realize that they need to make a product that's durable or robust or last, mm-hmm. like if it's a consumer product, maybe last 5 years. If it's a solar system, right, at 30 years, mm-hmm. or a vehicle, it's 20 years, or a washing machine, it's 10 years, or whatever their target duration is. And oftentimes they understand what the cost of failure is, right? They may experience it personally because it's a small team and they have to deal with field failures. But it's in the design process itself. You're exactly right, John. It's you know, you keep breaking it. Stop it.
Yeah, you're overstressing my product. I never intended it to do all that. So yeah, that's not the point. But
well, you find it, you know, and I'm sure you've found that you're teaching a class on what is accelerated testing, is that we're accelerating the stresses to cause these things to occur, or even another one we run into is, well, a designer said, well, that only happened once on one prototype. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I go, you know, Ed, and this is Ed I was working with one time, and I said, we only have 3 prototypes, right? And it's not a lot of samples, and we had it fail once with one of those and we quickly fixed it. That represents a 33% failure rate. Is that good enough?
it's a warning sign. It's telling you something, and then the convincing people to do stuff about it is the hard part when you're doing the early accelerated testing like that, which we have to do with the short development cycles we have now. And you know, getting them to realize that these techniques reveal potential problems, and then we have to investigate further to see what's really causing those. But I think it starts even earlier, getting involved up front as a reliability engineer, even during the requirements phase, and helping with understanding the customer's reliability requirements and working with the team to here's things we could do to help ensure we can meet those customer reliability needs, and also being involved in trade-off decisions. There's always trade-offs. There's always conflicting needs and requirements, and participating in those and showing where, okay, if we make that choice, it has this potential impact on reliability. And do we want to make that trade-off? So it's being part of that dialogue that goes on in the product team to make the best decisions we can to achieve a particular customer need.
Well, it's true. It's part of, there's a couple pieces in there that I want to highlight. Is one of them is it's exactly be part of the conversation right from the start. Oftentimes, though, it's very easy to measure, you know, does the functionality work, or are we hitting the cost targets, or are we on track to deliver on time? Is we need to quantify the reliability part. It's not just, you know, what's our failure rate? It's, well, what's the cost of that failure rate? So that it can be balanced with missing a time to market target or missing a cost target.
Yeah.
Right. So it's part of our contribution to the conversation is what's the context or risk that we're facing with reliability and keeping that forefront. Yet I find, and there was a book by Henry Petrosky called Design Paradigms. And I believe he's written a number of other books, and he's talked about this concept, is that most designers tend to design away from failure, right? It's just that we bring them too many failures and some that are kind of esoteric.
Yeah. That's true. The other part is the fact that reliability inherently involves uncertainty. We never know the reliability of a product till the end of the life cycle, and then it's mm-hmm. really too late to do anything about it. So unlike some of the other design parameters where they are more deterministic, we're dealing with more probabilistic kinds of parameters, and that's harder for some people to grasp. You know, they're used to having more definitive things in design, and at early stages, obviously, we're not going to have that. So we have to take what we do know and try to extrapolate it out and give them an indication of what is this going to do to the life and reliability, durability of the product.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, part of this equation, though, is that the problem is that we do a lot of work to identify how things fail. I mean, right from setting the goals, we have to guard ourselves and say, well, we want a 98% probability of success. And then most of people are hearing us say a 2% failure rate, right? And so we run all these tests, we run all these activities and FMEA. All right, let's talk about how bad your design is, right? So we're seen as pretty negative people in general. It's
it's usually seen as negative, and it's hard to get people to look at the positive side of it.
And yet there are opportunities where we're in a usually in a very unique position within an organization is we're one of the few groups in a design effort that really straddles a number of different disciplines. And we can go talk to the firmware folks and the electrical engineers and the hardware or the mechanical folks and the industrial design and so on and so on. And some problems really do require a multi-disciplined approach. And I'm thinking here, John, is more of our role as we may not have the engineering talent to solve, a grounding problem, right? Mm-hmm. Or an issue that affects crosstalk and timing. And the electric engineer knows it's a problem, but he needs mechanical support and some other parts of the team to sit down with him to solve it. And I've seen that happen many times, and I'm sure you have, is where the reliability person says, all right, this is an issue. And you, let's have a meeting and solve this thing. And sometimes that's all it takes. And it's our role of facilitator.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, really provides a solution space to help solve a reliability problem.
Yeah, we may have an awareness of the different technologies and techniques, but don't have the in-depth expertise to solve the problem. But we are broad enough in perspective to recognize there's a need there and get the right people together and absolutely be a facilitator. That's a key role for a reliability engineer.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't preclude though that, I find many reliability engineers actually have come from an engineering discipline, electrical, mechanical, or so on. And a part of our role is also then brainstorming, right? We see a problem and what are viable solutions? Let's assist with this, or here's some mock-ups, or here's some ideas, and then let the owning designer take it over from there.
Yeah.
So I think we can.
Yeah, and that can be done with, for example, we've found some failures in testing or even in the field, and then set up a session where you have a cause chain analysis where you get the appropriate product team members together and begin to brainstorm what could have caused this problem, and then that leads to a solution. But yeah, if you don't get that exchange of information, you may not get to the solution.
Well, I'm laughing because a number of meetings I've had like that where they all come in and they all have their arms crossed and they're all, you know, pointing at each other. It's your fault. It's your fault. It's your fault.
Yeah,
like, come on, guys, let's all sit on the same side of the table here. We're on the same team.
You know? Yeah. It's not about finding blame. It's about solving the problem.
So. That's right. Yeah. So that can be tricky as a facilitator to bring adversaries together. You know, in some cases, they're actually competing for resources, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And we're asking them to work together, and that's not natural in some teams, unfortunately. Yeah, it's part of it is we view the world differently. I think Dan Deans in a Dare to Know episode mentioned that reliability folks tend to look at the world from a failure space, right? And the engineering world tends to look at the world in a success space. You know, how can I make this bridge work? How can I make this widget work and make it successful? Whereas we look at all the ways it could come apart. And I think part of our role is to recognize that, sure, identifying problems is part of our contribution. Yet that message gets really old quick. We got to walk in with solutions or paths to solutions over and over again.
Yes, that's correct. If you don't Well, it's true in other areas as well. If you can point out problems, but okay, what are you going to do about it? What are the ways we could solve this issue? And coming in with some alternatives or ideas that can trigger the discussion and shift it more towards a more positive exchange of ideas rather than starting to point fingers at everybody else who caused the thing to happen. And that's not what we're trying to do. So, come into the meeting with, here's some things that may have seen as a reliability engineer on past programs that were done to solve problems, and your own knowledge of that particular technology. Granted, it may be more limited than some of the other team members, but it's enough to here suggest some things we've seen done, and that prompts the discussion to go further and bring some other things onto the table.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. The hardest way to come in with a solution is after you've had a major problem. One quick story, and I think you probably have a few to share too, is that I was working with inkjet printers, the HP's inkjet printers, and I was asked to take a look at an early prototype of a design, and they mounted the main circuit board that connected your computer basically to the printer vertically with just an edge connector at the base. And it stood about 8 inches tall, and it was unsupported in the cavity other than just at the base. And so if you put your hand up, straight up, fingers extended right in front of you, and then your other hand is back and forth, this mass that's running perpendicular to the circuit board. And it's a good size mass. It's where all the ink and the print head is and stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And so I looked at that and I said, I'm not a mechanical engineer. But that motion is going to make the circuit board flex and wiggle wave in the wind, basically.
Yeah.
Right. And they said, no, I would never do that. Nah, it's no problem. And then they went into great length at how difficult it would be to anchor the circuit board within the device. So it's like,
Yeah, that one's pretty obvious. I would be kind of surprised that, unsupported circuit boards are a pretty obvious problem. And of course, later on, if you do accelerated testing on them, it usually ends up breaking connections and stuff flying off of boards and things like that, because it's even in a printer where it's a fairly benign environment, you still got mechanical movement in there, print heads moving back and forth, and it's maybe a low level vibration, but it could end up with loosening connections and causing issues. So yeah, that's why it kind of points out that having different expertise team members look at a design, and to a mechanical engineer, that would be pretty obvious. And there are, the guys who do electronics packaging are generally mechanical engineers looking at both the structural side and the thermal side of packaging electronics.
Well, that's where the problem was, Dan, is that the mechanical guys were looking at the complexity of getting a mounting bracket somewhere else on that system and attaching to this really ugly mechanical structure of a circuit board, right? They just didn't want to touch it. And then the electrical guys, they were heads down creating the ASIC and the firmware and the circuit board, and they hand it off to the mechanical guys. You stick it in the board someplace. We don't care where it is. You just put it in. And so it was recognizing that and then saying, how are we, and they had basically set up their armor that this was the best solution. So we got into the lab, right? And we had just got a new high-speed camera, a high-speed video camera. And so we said, well, let's try this. We took the skins off. We stuck it on the cabinet and lit it up and started filming this thing and just turned it on. And a few seconds later, it stopped running. And so we're like, what's going on? So we looked back at the video again, but now in slow motion, and right you know, a millisecond or two before it failed, we saw this little capacitor just kind of floating off in a little spiral. You know? Yeah. And so we took the little video clip and said, here, watch this, and hit the button. And, oh, we got to fix that. It was just, didn't have to say a word, didn't have to do anything. But as we could demonstrate that it was a problem, and then we sat down and had the brainstorming session with mechanical folks and electrical folks about how we could set up a bracket and what would be a viable way to dampen this motion. And it was just the power of a short little video. It paid for that camera immediately.
Yeah. It's an expensive tool, but it can really reveal some interesting things, as can, say, real-time digital x-ray machines. You can x-ray things while they're operating, and, mm-hmm. and it reveals some interesting phenomenon going on that you wouldn't realize otherwise, and it can be pretty convincing evidence.
Well, that brings up the failure analysis part. You know, that's still dwelling in the failure side, but it bridges that getting to a solution sometimes. Like that moving the video x-ray or the dynamic x-rays, you can see things that are moving that are otherwise hidden. And so have you got, you know, have you used failure analysis that way to affect a solution?
Sure, absolutely. One of the key things to do is obviously acquire the failed samples and protect the evidence of the failure, but also try to reproduce the failure, taking some good product and looking at how could we precipitate that failure mechanism and to help understand it. And so getting some good samples and applying some stresses to it to help try to reproduce that failure mechanism, and using tools like X-ray to watch it, what goes on if it's a vibration or mechanical problem, and see how it does actually come apart and what might lead to that failure mechanism. So, yeah, it does tie into failure analysis quite a bit. And that becomes very convincing to team members, you know, they visualize and see, oh, that's what's happening. Then we need to do something different.
It is. And it's sometimes it's that forensic work. Well, what kind of fracture was it? Was it a shear or was it a ductile? Mm-hmm. Was it a metal fatigue? Those kinds of bits of evidence can help oftentimes lead to, oh, okay, now the engineer understands what the problem is and solutions become. Yeah, my favorite solution, though, to avoid, I should say, is, oh, we'll use what's it called, RT4? A glue, essentially.
Yeah.
We'll just glue everything down.
No. Sort of epoxy the stuff in place. And it can solve some issues, but that's not the best way to do it. It's to design things that are better supported and better board layout so that you don't have a particular mechanical issues like that.
That's right. That's right.
Some of the ones I've run into are like when you're using a commercial board for another application. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the way it was designed and mounted was for maybe a fairly benign environment, but now you're going to put it into some other environment.
Oh, yeah. So like taking a power supply for a desktop computer and putting it in a mobile router in a vehicle.
Yeah, something like that, where it's an entirely different stress environment. And you got to look at how is that supported and where are the components on it? Is there going to be resonance issues here that could lead to rapid mechanical failures of that unit? So it's maybe during the design review part of it, when you're looking at making choices like that, choosing components or assemblies is looking at what it was designed for. And then here's what putting it in an environment with a different series of stresses could do. And then look at ways to make that more robust or choose a more robust alternative if you're comparing several vendors, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like a topic for another episode is just it ties into what we're talking about in that we're often looking at, well, will this work or not? What's the failure route? Looking at solutions. But I think a big part of that is, and I've heard it, and I'm sure you have, is you make an objection like that. Yeah, it's cheaper, guys. And this is why. Because it won't work here. And that's usually not a great way to dampen their enthusiasm to find a solution. It doesn't get them started to find a better solution until we actually run into the problems. But if you are routinely coming to the table with solutions or the facility to help find solutions to make your product more reliable, you tend to avoid that naysayer type persona. And so that, I think, is the gist of this episode, is that, yeah, we work in failures. And be aware of that. What's your message when you come to the meeting? Are you helpful, helping find solutions, facilitating improvements? All of those elements are, I would say, as important as breaking things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's finding the weaknesses is one problem, but then being prepared to develop solutions to that to make it better is a lot better approach, and it's going to help avoid some of the confrontational finger pointing and blame focus that some meetings have if you don't look at the positive solutions and how you fix this.
You really don't want to be the guy at the table after they launch the product and they all look at you. It's your fault.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're the one that's talking about failures all the time. Now it doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's not a good discussion.
No, not at all.
All right. Well, as listeners to the show, I'm sure you've recognized this and may have actually experienced it. You know, how do you approach the team meetings or reviews or the different engagements that you have with your teams to help them find solutions? You know, we come to the table oftentimes with failures, with here's how it didn't work, or we're projecting it won't work, or all these negative type things. Is what works for you? What kind of stories do you have that flip that table around so that you become prepared to help make the product more reliable, not just find failures? We'd love to hear from you. John and I are both accessible through the Ascendo Reliability site, or you could find the podcast network at reliability.fm. And I guess, John, one more plug for the RAMS conference coming up in late January. And this would be a topic to gather, or a place that we could gather stories like this. You know, what are the success stories you've had, and maybe make that a feature for if we can collect enough of those little pieces of, you know, what's a success story? That might make a nice addition to the show.
Sure, absolutely. That would be a real good discussion topic.
All right. Well, we'd have to, you know, get everybody in the audience to sign an NDA and all that other good stuff. But
the problem with examples sometimes is the release of proprietary information and techniques, and so that gets difficult sometimes. But you can generalize it enough to work around that sometimes.
Yeah, definitely, and I think it's not so much the tools and techniques we use, although I think that helps. It's how do we influence the teams we're working with so they see the risk that we see and are willing to take action on it. And that I'm sure we can talk about, the human side of what we do. So,
yeah.
All right, cool. Well, I'm really looking forward to meeting with you, John, and I know Kirk's going to be there. Carl's going to be there. I believe Adam's going to be there. So we'll have pretty much a crowd plus 500 or maybe 700 of our other comrades in reliability engineering and related fields are going to be there. So it should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we should have some good group discussions.
Yeah, definitely will. All right. Well, thanks, John. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.